the tools are going to change on you. Don't become too invested in learning one tool or framework.
Hi, everyone. Welcome and thank you for joining me. My name is Franco Variano, and I'll be your host for the Tech Plus Art podcast. Tech Plus Art is the community for curious individuals and creators who are looking to make a dent in the universe. Together, we're exploring the new frontiers of creativity, humanity, and how emerging technologies will continue to shape our culture, professions, products, and much more. Join me on this journey as we speak with artists, makers, researchers, designers, and creators from all backgrounds and fields. Tech Plus Art is an inclusive community, and we make all our content for you. So we want to hear from you. If you've got any suggestions, topics you'd like us to explore, or contribute to yourself, let us know on Twitter or via the website. You can check us out at maketechart.com or at maketechart everywhere else. So with that said, let's get to today's episode. Today we're chatting with Kyle Phillips, a creative technologist who's blending design and development to create projects related to generative art and creative tooling. Kyle is part of Google's Creative Lab in New York City, where he works on technology experiments like Teachable Machine. Kyle and I had an awesome conversation around his creative process, how he's building tools that help other creative coders, and much more. I definitely recommend checking out his work by visiting his site in the show notes below or at haptic-data.com. Now let's get started. Hey, Kyle, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate, you know, having you on and getting to learn a little bit more about you. So let's start there. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, where are you from? What was it like growing up?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Iowa City. It's a small Midwest college town, obviously very different than where I live now in New York. And I had a yard with like a bunch of woods behind it. I lived in like a cul-de-sac with a bunch of other kids my age, and where we'd play tag at night, take over the street for roller hockey. Skateboarded a lot as a kid. My older brother would like race four-wheelers, and we would go to my grandpa's farm an hour away, like ride them through the cornfields. Like my brother and sister and myself, we all kind of had like some sport or activity that involved a lot of like failure and some risk. We all were kind of like encouraged to take risks in those activities and to kind of keep trying and not be afraid of getting hurt, which definitely happened. I think that was important. I think like that built like a lot of resilience in us. And I think that's like a really important quality to someone that's like trying to learn to code and pick up other tasks that really involve like a lot of upfront failure.
Absolutely. That's super interesting. And so at what point did you learn how to code? At what point were you exposed to generative design and creative technology? Where did that come into the fold?
Yeah, I made my first website when I was 12 in like 1996. A friend of mine was showing me PlayStation cheats on the internet, and I was just kind of in shock that they were there for free. And so we both just kind of started making, you know, bad little HTML websites, you know, in like free services like Angel Fire and GeoCities, and kind of just worked kind of on our own projects and kind of pushed each other to get better. So I made like really silly websites at first, like websites for like PlayStation cheats or like a gallery of anime images or punk MP3s, or I had a somewhat popular fan site for the band Tool. So just kind of like a bunch of random things like that. I think like one thing that was really kind of like a funny turn of events for me was like I would do everything on my dad's computer at home, and I started getting onto like IRC, like this chat service, and I found some hacker related channel. And I began asking just people in that channel if they would teach me how to hack. And a few strangers like started to chat with me, and they sent me like a Trojan, and I downloaded it, of course. And they just began deleting all my dad's files. So my dad's computer, when I went to restart it, it wouldn't turn back on. That's how I got my first computer. My dad and I just bought all the parts and made a computer just for me. I was really excited. I had a sound card, first computer I had with audio. So that was kind of like a big turning point for me, because finally I had this computer that was just mine and I could really kind of customize it and do whatever I wanted with it. So that kind of became like a big turning point for me. I found this like website that offered like free like logos for you. And I filled out like this form, and they sent me back this like green marble banner with like a thick chiseled bevel and like a PlayStation logo, and it said like Kyle P's homepage on it. I thought it was amazing. So that was like basically how I started learning Photoshop. I would just start being in all these Photoshop forums, doing tutorials on making like buttons and rusty wires. And I just started making sites to like kind of showcase those designs that I was making in Photoshop back then. Yeah, so that was kind of like the late 90s for me. Some of those are still like up on the Wayback Machine and stuff like that. That was just kind of what I was doing when I was really young. I think maybe it's interesting that like I never once really thought of this as like a profitable skill. It was like even through like high school, I really couldn't have ever imagined that I would be doing this as a living. It was just something that like became really important to me. I'm fairly convinced that 2001 was the year that kind of informed a lot of what I do now. In 2001, there was no money on the internet. The bubble had burst, and I viewed the internet largely as a place for artists. So I would visit like all of these design blogs that are gone now. K10K was a popular one. And a common style of internet art back then was these nonlinear narratives, kind of designed experiences using various browser mechanics, kind of a choose your own adventure style of navigation, often with like links hidden all over the page and hard to find. And they were often released as kind of like issues, kind of like temporary exhibitions or like internet zines where they'd be up for a few months and then they'd probably be replaced with something else soon. Making those kind of like nonlinear narratives became like an emotional outlet for me as a teen. So I viewed the internet largely as like a gallery that no one could tell me I wasn't good enough to be included in.
That's super cool. And so when you talked about like, you know, not seeing it as a commercial type of thing, but rather a place for artists and a way to express yourself, how did that play into some of your early career and some of the stuff you did afterwards?
It just really naturally led me into the direction of approaching it from what I wanted to make and then figuring out whatever it was I needed to learn in order to create that. I didn't really understand the difference between design and code so much. I just knew that I kind of wanted to make this nonlinear narrative, this kind of issue, and I knew that I didn't yet have all of the skills to do it. And I just kind of tried to break down piece by piece what I would need to learn to accomplish it. So I think that just became a really organic way of kind of learning and navigating the space. My intentions were always very oriented towards what I wanted. Also, I think that it really kind of, it didn't make me see any sort of barricade to it. Like I didn't think, oh, I'm going to need to learn a bunch of math to be able to accomplish this, or, oh, there's going to be something really difficult that I don't perceive myself as good at. I just kind of tried to work at it piece by piece and knew I could come up with something.
Super interesting. Yeah. And so how did that kind of explorative path, piecing things together, lead you to what you're doing today with Google's Creative Lab in New York City? Like, can you tell us more about both the lab and the type of work you do today, how you've evolved from that type of stuff?
Yeah, so Creative Lab it's around like 130 people, around like 90 of us or so are here in New York. And we're kind of split into a few different teams. And I kind of aimed to get to Creative Lab for a while. As I was kind of doing that work earlier in my career, you know, like these kind of impactful like web experiences were obviously something that was really interesting to me. I went to school for making some of these types of things, and I saw, you know, Creative Lab was doing this work later on in my career. So I kind of picked them out as a place that was really doing ones that I thought mattered. So Creative Lab kind of exists in a few different subgroups within the New York office. There's like one kind of subgroup that kind of specializes especially in film-related projects. They do like Super Bowl ads and stuff like that. I'm on a team that kind of focuses more on technology experiments. So I tend to do a lot of projects at the lab that focus on either some graphics programming, or I also really like to build a lot of tools. A lot of my work tends to fit in those two categories. So I did like a project a few years ago called AutoDraw that was really kind of both. It was a graphics tool. And I recently did Teachable Machine, which is very much so a tool. It has some graphic stuff, but it's really not the essential part of the work. So I've done a lot of stuff at Creative Lab that have been oriented towards other creative coders, you know, open sourcing most of what I make, and trying to kind of just often create kind of like provocations in spaces that I think could be interesting. So I've done like Android experiments, open sourcing like all of the code for how to kind of use Android as a creative platform, help build this large pixel wall that we have at the office that's like the lobby when you walk in, a few thousand arcade buttons with LEDs inside them, and open source kind of all of the hardware schematic and software for that with our partners. So I try to always kind of be working on things that involve open sourcing of tools at the end.
Absolutely. That's super cool. And so speaking of tools and some of those, you know, projects that you highlighted here, like, and they're up on your site, which we'll link to, because there's a lot of really cool projects up there, especially some generative like design systems or graphics engines, like you were just talking about. So how do you approach, you know, building those systems? How do you balance the potential for a creative outcome with, you know, the project requirements or usability? How do you think about those two things?
It's always kind of something something you have to approach on every single project a little bit differently. I think one of the things that I really love about creating generative art and coding in general is that nothing is fixed. You can forever just create endless iterations of an idea, and you can take all of the tools that you wrote with you and you can apply them to the next one. So as you get better at building tools, there's really no starting over. You can kind of just take that with you and build on it differently. I often approach a sketch by kind of visualizing an output that I think I might want to get and attempt to kind of work backwards to think of what system would create that. Other times I'll do kind of like a simple conditional design experiment. Like I'll write out rules for myself, like plot 20 points on a grid, grow a line at 60 degrees angle, and periodically rotate the line in 60 degrees until it intersects with another line. You know, and I'll just kind of think of something basically like that and then just kind of try to code it and see what I like about it when it works. The balance between predictability and potential to surprise is usually what I'm really trying to work towards getting right. It's really important to me. I want to have a piece that can surprise me when I run it, that is like possible of creating something I didn't necessarily expect. So I want to have some aspect of chaos in it. I think that's necessary. But if it's too much chaos, it's not going to give me like pleasing results or come through with intention. And I always want to put a piece of myself into my work and for it to look like sculpted and intentional. Now, I always remember that I had a professor that once said to me, every time you use a random function, that proves to me this decision is void of meaning. So I still use it and I don't completely buy into his belief, but I kind of am critical of letting it play a heavy hand in my work. And I just kind of have that in the back of my mind a lot of times.
And so you talked, you know, about a few of those projects and making those decisions. What has been your most ambitious project to date? Where, what was the, you know, the one thing where you were working towards getting that potential for surprise just right?
I'm constantly have like a backlog of projects. And I think my most ambitious project to date is one that I've kind of come to terms with that I will probably never finish. So I built this, I call it Spires, a web-based editor for generating these kind of foreign looking like architectural sculptural objects in WebGL that kind of constructed with the sort of lathe based geometry. I designed it as if it was like on a remote planet and wove this whole narrative around it of like machines are on this planet mining materials and they're able to 3D print these creations. You as a user, you can kind of design them and leave them in kind of this public gallery and database, as well as like there's a whole planet that you can kind of pick a plot of land on and use those kind of blueprints for like creating like distributions and like plots of like small towns on this planet. And I had it like working in like WebXR with like Vive, and I ran into some hard problems with it, and it became clear to me that I also just had so much work remaining. But it's been really ambitious and really fun to see a lot of stuff come out of it. I share that stuff on Twitter and Instagram every once in a while. At work, I think my last two projects have been really ambitious. I did a project last year called Creatability, which was like 7 experiments exploring creative applications for those with accessibility needs. So I created like web components focused on accessibility and created like kind of a novel method of like interacting with a website using PoseNet for those with limited mobility. So you could say draw with your nose, play keyboard with your nose, or any other body part. So we created like a series of tools working with other partners and with people that had these needs, created like a drawing tool that like sonicates your drawing. So you could hear the drawing like pan left to right with where you were drawing and like frequency low to high on the y-axis. And we worked with, my friend Yotong worked with a deaf composer and made kind of his ideal audio visualization tool. We made all of those. They're up on the internet for free, open source the components. Yeah, and then recently for the past year, I've been working on Teachable Machine. So several of us have been working on this. It's been a really difficult project, because it's had a lot of different like branches out from it. We've done research with patients with ALS, kind of explore how these machine learning models that are like personalized to one can help them. And we've worked with schools like NYU to be creating like prototypes and different experiments. And that's just really been a different level of work, because a lot of people depend on it. So we have a lot of teams like inside Google, and people like MIT Media Lab have used it to develop AI and ethics curriculums. Policy workers have been using it for kind of becoming more informed on policies they're making. There's just like a lot more requires it to be like kind of continued to work on and to make sure that it is stable and has features that people want. Those have been kind of my most ambitious projects, I think, which are all kind of current ones. So I think that's a good trend.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's super cool. And I think we had Irene on a couple months ago, right before the big update to Teachable Machine. So it's been amazing to see the type of work that you guys have put into that platform and how far it's come.
Yeah, Irene's on the same kind of subgroup as me at Creative Lab. Her, me, Jonas, several others, we all have worked on Teachable Machine for about a year now. And putting our own ideas and things we really knew from the beginning we each really wanted out of it, putting that into the tool. And we did this project a bit differently, where a lot of the core features kind of came out of research that happened during prototype. There's a lot of features that we figured out during the research phase that ended up becoming really important to the tool that we really hadn't realized until we got into actually using it with people.
One thing you mentioned a moment ago was your creative process, where, you know, you start with a visualized idea of the output you're looking for, and then you progressively work backwards from there to try to figure out what the components are, what you might need to learn, what you might need to create. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that? Can you dive into that process of trying to figure out what all these little things are and how that leads into the desired product that will help you achieve that vision?
I think, you know, to some extent, if you're consistently making work, then you're not often finding yourself without some sort of kind of starting point. I feel like a lot of times I have some idea that I'm starting to build. In the middle of it, I realize some tool that is really going to help me build that thing. And then in the middle of building the tool, I realize some other thing I could build with that tool. And a lot of times it just kind of becomes this endless cycle of, you know, which I think explains why I have so many unfinished projects. I just am constantly branching off of common threads, I think. And so I think I'm exploring a lot of nearby territory in those ways. There's kind of different processes between work and my personal work. I think that really explains my personal work, where I kind of am trying to have like some element of self-expression, and I have some system I'm interested in, and it's probably based off of something that I had kind of already been playing with a bit. And in those cases, I'm kind of working between ideas in my head, maybe eventually like some design in Figma or Photoshop. But usually is always starting in code for me. And then at work, I feel like it's more intentional. At work, it's about what is important and why it should be us making it. And we're kind of constantly meeting with other teams to discover opportunities, or we have something we're very passionate about. We're trying to formulate an idea with others in the form of prototypes, design, slides, docs to understand and kind of like upfront, like what's its purpose and impact. So I think at home, where I kind of just wander a bit in my personal work, in work, it's very like directional, and it starts with kind of the upfront intent. That intent is born out of just our own personal interest and how we can fit that in, or something just really compelling that we've come across.
That's super cool. Yeah, no, I really like that distinction between the two. And it's very insightful to, I guess, think about it in that way and really, you know, be able to separate, but draw those ideas together. And I really like and appreciate what you said about, you know, never needing to start over, being able to take stuff with you because you're always pushing an idea or a requirement kind of forward, and it's giving you all kinds of new branches. I guess kind of on the topic of those branches and building and doing more stuff, like, what do you think is missing in this industry at large? What do you wish existed? Which I guess some of it might be the things that you're contributing back in terms of open source, but just around the creative tech scene, the generative design scene, what do you see as lacking or not lacking?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one is like, where do I think the design and the tech is headed? Another is like, what do I wish was kind of there? And the third is kind of, what do I think is helpful for people to be more so spending their time in? What I kind of wish was there was more inclusive tools and less of a need for people to immediately jump into like fields that have been defined by like years of solving hard engineering problems. You know, I kind of miss a little bit of like the days of when there were more effortful users on the web. I would say that's something I kind of have experienced in the past that has shifted a lot. People, you know, used to like spend minutes to load a single web page, and you used to really expect something from it. And now I think that has kind of shifted away from these experiences because people kind of just want things fast, myself included. Yeah, I guess where I see like the tools headed, I think like when it comes to generative art in tech, like there's definitely a big push towards AI, using AI for a lot of new creations. And then there's better tooling. So you see a lot of people moving towards things like Unity that provides them, you know, a lot of different tools for visualizing their output in ways other than just code. You see a lot of like visual programming, like Touch Designer or Shader Graph inside Unity. You see combination like hybrid tools like Houdini, where Houdini is, you know, it's going to output motion graphics, but it's going to give you kind of these nodes to be kind of, you know, visual programming in, and as well as like the ability to like write code. So I think that these are kind of common paths. that are going to be, you know, increasingly prevalent. Yeah, I'm not sure if I kind of wandered a bit in that one, but
I think like you got through and I think you touched on a lot of really important things. And so I think, you know, taking that a step further, based on those hybrid paths or those paths that are becoming more prevalent, like what is some advice that you would share with somebody who's just getting started based on what you know now and seeing those paths of starting points? Like what would you say to somebody who's just coming in and kind of looking around and trying to figure out like, where do I start? What should I pick?
Directly on that, I think it reminds me of something when I remember when I really had this realization of the tools are going to change on you. Don't become too invested in learning one tool or framework because they're going to change. You should invest in how you can learn new tools, new languages, and above everything, like invest in your ideas and find ways to execute them. So the things that are all right now seem like the most important thing to learn and to approach that technically, you know, at some point that tool probably isn't going to still be solving your same problem or still be the choice that is most popular amongst the communities. So I think really it's, you know, trying to step back from what is it you want to accomplish and how can you figure that out now? And how can you set yourself up for knowing that that might not be the way you do it 5 years from now?
Yeah, absolutely. No, very super valid point, especially with the pace of, you know, the tech industry and the way things kind of move forward with hardware, software, everything. It's 5 years is a very short time.
Yeah.
So I guess like on that note, like what's next for you? Any projects or focuses that you can share? I know we talked a lot about unfinished projects and new starting points, but anything like personal, professional that you can talk about, you know, being focused on over the next couple of months?
One thing I can say is that I am still definitely active on Teachable Machine. There's still a lot happening in that space, and I'm continuing to kind of explore new scopes within Teachable Machine, as well as to kind of enable and ease new Teachable Machine powered experiences. So a lot of people are using it and testing it on the site and making personal experiments with it. I think there's still a lot that I can do to help people with what they want to make after the model has been made. So I've been spending a lot of time just thinking of that tail end part of the experience a lot, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. It's awesome. And so maybe just as a way of wrapping up, any last words, shout outs, resources that you would share with other people that, people need to go check out or anything like that?
You know, if you're going to, there's a lot of different creative communities out there. You know, Twitter obviously is a great way to be just following a lot of the people you're interested in and becoming connected to kind of the areas you're most interested in and define your own group. I think there's a lot of good conferences that are out there that are valuable to go to. You know, I usually always go to IO Festival, EYEO. If you're trying to get into this scene and you don't have much coding experience, I think something like P5JS is great. P5JS is going to like allow you to kind of get that first experience of like random colored rectangles and random positions on a screen and make you feel like you had a success, and it's going to do that for you really quickly. So I think the P5JS is a great place to kind of get started, find a community, find a bunch of examples, and start just modifying those examples and feeling more and more ownership over what you make.
Yeah, absolutely. Really good advice. Kyle, thanks so much for taking the time to be on the show, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining me for another episode of Tech Plus Art Podcast. We're a very small team behind this project, so we greatly appreciate all your support. If you love our content and these podcasts, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts and sharing it with a friend or two. This really does go a long way in helping us get discovered and reach more creators. As always, you can find us online at maketechart.com or at maketechart everywhere else. See you soon.